everyone, and welcome back to the MAR podcast. I'm Nizha, I'm your host. I cover topics related to change makers today. I'm also co-hosted with my colleague Arifa. I feel like colleague sounds so formal, but I'm with Arifa today. And we also have a special guest. So Arifa, if you would want to introduce our guest for today.
Of course, Nizha. With pleasure, I would like to introduce Shahanaz Rahman, also known as Mona the Explorer on social media. Not only is she a special guest on here, but also a very dear friend of mine. So thanks so much for joining us today on our podcast, Mars the Word, and sharing your experience with myself, Nizha, and our listeners. A bit of background about Mona. Mona's background ranges from psychology. So she's a psychology graduate with some experience within the field, and also having some corporate experience under her belt. But today we will primarily focus on her work with Survivors Together, a project running for over 10 years now. Mona is lead of the project, which seeks to support vulnerable women and girls who have unfortunately been subjected to abuse, and more specifically, sexual abuse.
Thank you very much, Arifa, for the very kind introduction. And thank you to you both, Arifa and Nizha, for having me here today.
No problem. We're glad to have you. Yeah. So we wanted to learn more about your work. Just to elaborate further, how would you describe your work?
So I've been supporting Survivors Together for the last 4 years. So I kind of consider myself as a support worker. I'm not a counsellor. I'm not a therapist as such. Our aim of the group is merely to support individuals, particularly women here, really, for our group, to help them. From their early years to the later years, really, for the experience that they've gone through, to be a helping hand, as to be a social support more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. And how do you do that, like, in particular? So I know Arifa mentioned about how you work with victims of sexual abuse and general maybe physical abuse. So I kind of wanted to know why, what was your motivations for doing that? How do you, like, conduct that? Like, just a mm-hmm. bit more mm-hmm. into that, yeah. How's the journey with that?
Survivors Together started many years ago. I think it's basically, it was a charity that I was volunteering for during my early days at university, really. And at that time, the group was merely for middle-aged to elderly, you know, groups of women who've experienced child sexual abuse at their early years. And when I joined them, we didn't have a group for young people. And I thought that it's if I'm going to support someone with those sort of experiences, it's important that we start that early. So they have, a little bit easier adulthood going forward. So we started this the young women's group from scratch, really. I think the idea of that is really and truly to make young people aware. You'd be surprised how many young girls go through experiences and have no idea they're going through that and what to do about it. Because it's such a taboo topic. You know, regardless of culture and background, it's not something that's really easy to talk about. And what do you really do? So the idea was that we reach out to young people, like in colleges and schools, and make them understand if that's something they have gone through at their early ages, that there is an organization out here that can help them. You know, it's not necessarily like a therapy session where you have to go in and it's a little bit intense. It's just, you know, we're offering a service where we would say that here is a room and you can meet other survivors who've gone through similar things to you. You don't have to talk about your experiences. You just, you know, stay in the same room, do a few fun activities together. So if you ever need a helping hand who understands your experience, you have that support, you see. And our organization would offer one-on-one sessions with them if they want somebody to hear them out. We're here to do that. And majority of the staff members are survivors themselves. So they really, truly understand what it's like to be a survivor. And there is also some like coping strategies and other things. And we would just meet, you know, once in a month or twice in a month, depending on how much funding we had, etc. That sort of thing, really. That was the nature of our group. But we did have links to proper professional therapy or counseling if needed. We could advise them to do that, but we never carried out such practices ourselves.
So touching upon that, you've mentioned how it is actually a taboo subject, of course, in society. And you've kind of mentioned, you know, it's something that not everyone wants to speak about, rightly so, you know, depending on the comfort level and all that kind of stuff, it is a personal thing. So how do these girls reach out to you then? Is it something that's just like open, I guess, is it like a helpline or something where they just kind of call up and then you've got somebody who's actually, you know, kind of following up this case study and they get allocated? Or is it something that is kind of referrals? How does it work?
We do actually the opposite. So we're not a services that people should reach out to for. I think our services are here to actually make women reach out for help. So we would often do that. We'd actually go reach out to colleges and, you know, and universities and schools and just speak to the women, because, you know, these are the topics. And because child sexual abuse is very different to sexual abuse that you receive as an adult. It's very, very different, because as a child, when you're an adult and you didn't experience any child sexual abuse or anything like that, somebody touches you against your will, you know how to stand up for it if you want to, right? You have that choice. But as a child, you didn't necessarily have those choices. So I think the way they grow up, the way they see the world is very different to a normal adult. So it's kind of making those people understand that if you went through that, and these are the topics, unless you hear it, you don't necessarily think there's something wrong even. Because, you know, like children, when you're a child, you're so naive and innocent, you know, it's like a child. If they fall somewhere in the garden, for example, they won't necessarily come and tell you unless they actually got hurt, because they live in the moment. So even child sexual abuse is that when it does happen to them, it's often suppressed as an adult because it's so traumatic. It's sometimes it's just suppressed and they don't necessarily think about it. So our aim was out to go there and say, this topic is okay to talk about. And it's not to trigger people and make them feel like, okay, I went through something really bad. It's like, it's always at the back of their mind. And a lot of the time survivors wouldn't come to our group and never actually share their experiences. And no one actually has to. If you come to me or our group and tell me, I am a survivor, we won't necessarily push you to give us details. It's just, we accept that you have this and we just want to help you out here. So you understand. The minute you realize it's actually very common, because it's very common. 1 in 3 women experience sexual abuse, and a lot of them is child sexual abuse. 1 in 6 in men, they experience that. It's so, so, so common. But when somebody hits you and you're actually like verbally abused or physically abused, somebody punched you in the face, it's easy to call up a helpline and ask for help because you can witness that, right? If it's rape, it's easy to seek help for. But child sexual abuse isn't quite the same. So you have to do the other way around. You actually have to reach out to them and find the survivors, if that makes sense, and get them out of it, to help them really.
Yeah. So what would you say are like, I know there's quite a few signs in trying to figure out which child is undergoing abuse and whatnot. What would you say, like, what is kind of the standard in which your organization works through in identifying signs of child sexual abuse? Because I think it's very covert, isn't it? So what, yeah.
I think that's a really good question, Liz. But I think before we even get to that question, how do we even define sexual abuse? Because we're kind of going into it, we're delving into it, straight into it. Nuz and I have just kind of asked you all the questions.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we haven't even defined, like, what's the difference or the distinction. Is there, like, two types of sexual abuse? Is there the, you know, the non-contact and contact? Do you want to, like, kind of elaborate a little bit on that before we actually run with Nuz's question?
Absolutely. We would consider child sexual abuse any experiences sexually that happens to you before the age of 18. But of course, teenagers, when they, you know, develop certain feelings and they can consent, two teenagers consent to each other, that's different. So we wouldn't consider that as an abuse. It's just, I mean, child sexual abuse typically happens before the understanding of sexual, feelings. So anything before that age, if that's someone has touched you, of course, that is child sexual abuse. But anything, then that could be up to 18. Anyone touches you against your, that's child sexual abuse itself. And obviously any sexual abuse after that is just sexual abuse.
Okay. Nuz, would you like to ask your question again? I'm sorry.
That's fine. No, because it's interesting. I think it was important to ask that because I feel like a lot of the time with survivors, I think it's a combination of things with regarding to how sexual abuse and child abuse are represented within media. And it's hard to sometimes openly resonate with it because obviously when presented it with it, in some cases it's very sensationalized and it's quite the extreme of sexual abuse, and that's what grabs the front pages of newspapers, that's what's are turned into like Netflix docs and whatnot, and it really kind of distance our like kind of more covert experiences with sexual abuse. And like you said, it is very, very common, and in some ways I feel as though many, many women and many like men and women can relate to this in terms of there were more subtle examples of sexual exploitation at that age, that because it wasn't outright rape, because it wasn't complete like contact in like, because obviously we have different even our notion of what sexual intercourse is and sexual interaction is different depending on different cultures, different circumstances, and to an individual. It's hard to recognize when something is sexual abuse, but I think like Mona has stated, it's the idea of prior to the age of even understanding your sexual, your sexuality and your being, to be exploited in that manner. Because again, you can't decipher it, because if you've never experienced it, you really can't like figure out what it is that's happening to you and have that kind of critical understanding, because you are just a child. Because that's what I feel like, yeah, that's what I feel the most resonates with me, in the sense that there are just certain times where it's very, very covert, very like, I don't like the word normalized, but it's just kind of brushed under the rug, in the sense of, oh, that's just a normal interaction or affection and whatnot. And it becomes difficult, because it also can lead to policing who can and can't interact with the child and how they interact, because not everything comes with, you know, malicious intentions. But yeah, I think it's important to, yeah, like I said, recognizing signs in children. Recognizing signs in children, and what you would see, like going back to my original question, like what would you say are like kind of signs of sexual abuse in children?
Yes, before I touch on that, I just thought it would be important to kind of mention that, to understand what truly sexual abuse is, like, you know, every family has their different standards of showing affection, but it's never okay to kiss a child in the mouth, you know, at any age, right? So I think teenager wants to kiss somebody above the age of 18, legally it's wrong. They can't do that. They can only, you know, do certain things within their own age group. So anything, there's legal clarity in there. And I think with the way you can, I mean, there's no services out there actually that, you know, we don't, and you cannot ever have that service either, unfortunately. You won't go to people's houses and be like, here's a child, let's see, is the child behaving like they've been abused? Not to serve, that can't happen, right? So the only way you could actually help children not to go through that is having a preventative method, in by which you actually teach them, right, what is wrong and what is right. Because what happens with child sexual abuse, you only hear about it when they're an adult, when they're 25, 23, 18. That's many years back that has happened. It's very rare a child sexual abuse case happens as it is, unless a parent has caught it, right? Because child sexual abuse only happens by trusted family members or trusted friends. A random stranger on the street won't be able to touch your child. That doesn't work. So it's always people that you know, and the people you trust, okay? Yeah. So it only comes out, you know, real time when a parent has caught it. Otherwise, it's never heard of, unless a child comes out much later when they're an adult. So the only way we can make a difference in this world, in this particular matter, is by having a preventative method whereby you actually tell children only mummy and daddy or the parent carer, whoever they happen to be, can touch, you know, can give you a shower, can take you to the bathroom and wait outside, or change your clothes, or that sort of boundaries you have to teach your children. Because children, you know, that they live in the moment. As much as you teach them those things, you know, they will still forget about that, you know. Like, you have a child and they're playing in the garden and everyone's having ice cream and a perverted uncle or a cousin brother or a friend is touching them up. Unless it's actually hurt the child and it actually resonated with them, they will forget about it in 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Right. It's just one of those things. It's just like, you just have to be so careful with children. They will forget that. And I think the preventative method number one is to kind of like to teach them that what are the boundaries, and then having check-in points with them. You see, I'm sure you have, like, you know, you don't have to have children to do that. You have, I'm sure you, you know, Arifa has, you know, nephews and nieces. Mm-hmm. Nusa, you probably have family members with their children, right?
Yeah.
You see how they're like. So it's just like, you just I think every adult like ourselves has a responsibility. If you know any child, have that conversation with their parents, because parents sometimes, you know, because they trust their friends so much and all the other family members, it doesn't cross their minds always. That's why it's so easy to do child sexual abuse, because you trust them, and also to the child as well, like, see it from their perspective, like you, right? Because you trust your friends so much, you wouldn't necessarily feel so uncomfortable to leave your child with your friend, would you? Right? It's very difficult to get into that dark mindset. And because the child also sees that particular person as such a trusted member by the family, even if they do something wrong to the child, it doesn't resonate. If a stranger was to touch that same child, they would talk about that because it's different for them. But because it's a trusted member, the child doesn't even recognize there's something wrong, you see? So
yeah, I think also, I think in the point you made about bodily autonomy over children, like teaching them autonomy over their own body is so incredibly important. And I think it's interesting because funnily enough, I have a little sister, she's only 5. And I think a lot of the time, I think the reason why, again, it's such a difficult topic to have is that people don't want to think about their, you know, members of their family, like vulnerable members of their family in positions like that, in such compromising situations, and just hope for the best and pray for the best. And I think what is also a worry, particularly in more conservative families, is like, how can I explain to my baby, my little child, about sex and, or, you know, consent or whatever? These seem like adult topics. And I think what's interesting is that it doesn't have to be that way. Like, just from personal experience, like with my little sister, we've like tried to, like, in a way of creating an understanding of consent, is that we have like, we, so for example, if she doesn't want to give someone a kiss or a hug or whatever, she does not have to, like, you know, sometimes in general, some family members will be like, oh, you know, give this, go hug this uncle, go hug this auntie or whatever, but allowing a child to say, you know, no, I don't want to, and that being respective. And also within our household, we have like a distinction, it's quite silly, but it's like magical kiss and then physical kiss, like a little kiss. So sometimes we want to give affection to her, but she doesn't want it, like she's not in the mood or whatever, and she's completely entitled to that. I think it's very easy because I think, oh, I'm her sister, she's got nothing to worry about. But the fact that she would tell us, like, we ask her, like, can we give one a real kiss, or can we have like a you know, a magical kiss? A magical kiss is like a little air kiss, and it just shows, like, you know, before we're leaving the house, or like, you know, if we're going away. And she just, like, sometimes you just want to give that affection, but, you know, you have to also respect that this is a child, and these little habits and whatnot is going to set them up for later. So even maybe I'm leaving the house after for a while and I'm not going to see her, she doesn't really comprehend that I want to hug her a kiss. But like, knowing that she can just say, you know what, you can give me a magical kiss, it's fine, and then moving on with our day. Those little things, I think, and it gives me peace of mind knowing that she has that, like, understanding that no one's allowed to, even my own sister or whatever, is allowed to touch me without my consent. And it doesn't have to be like consent as a word and this complex like idea surrounding it. It can be something as simple as that. Like, that's something that's really been helped me to like communicate that with her, just like something
that's really interesting.
Yeah. It's a very behavioral way of consenting, isn't it?
Well, that's really interesting that you mentioned that, because you're kind of saying that it starts from a young age. It's not something that you kind of just learn at school or at college or whatever, but it's really from home, from the very beginning, in your formative years, or in your childhood, infant days, where you're actually learning and you pick up these things, not necessarily through conversation, but through behavior as well. I think there's a very small, we have a similar thing actually, and I really like the concept of the magical kiss.
Me too. I think I'm going to use that on my knees.
let's all have that. Yeah, it's really cute. I was also the idea of like tickling, for example. So I used to have this habit of like tickling my nephew, and he'll be like, no. And then I'd be like, oh, and then I'd be like, okay, fine. And then initially I'd be like, oh, but you know, you're just having a little fun, it's fine. And then you kind of realize, actually, like, hold on a minute, he's just said to me he doesn't like tickling, and I know he's laughing about it, but really I need to respect the fact that that's his body, and that he's only, my nephew's 5 years old now, and you know, he's, it's all like nice and cute for us as adults, be like, oh, you know, it's nice to see them with their little, well, with their huge smiles and stuff, but it's really the fact that that's his body, and respecting his body is important. It's just like the way somebody's probably like tapped you or touched you in a way and you don't like it, and you're actually saying, excuse me, but please don't do that, I'd rather not have you do that. It's just important, and I think we forget because they're children, often it's overlooked, and it's really important not to do that, because you know, they're people at the end of the day, they are their own human beings, and they're going to develop into adults one day, and it's our duties, as you know, whether we're primary carers or not, aunties, uncles, you know, whether we're teachers, if we're in schools, we need to remember that there are boundaries that we need to make sure we don't overstep, because these people are going to be the next generation of adults. So yeah, definitely going back to the whole idea of it starts from a young age, and it's not necessarily something that you have to learn through conversation all the time. It is, a lot of the stuff that we do learn is very much picked up on as we're growing up, I suppose. So yeah, that's really interesting. But in terms of like going back to picking up on the picking up on whether, how do we find out whether a child is being abused? Of course, not necessarily, it's not necessary that the child will say that I'm being abused in this way or that. Are there any kind of telltale signs, like, I don't know, they might be shying away or they might be a little more reserved or anything like that, whether that's at school or at home? Are there certain telltale signs that are kind of important to note at all, Mona?
And I think that comes from, there are certain things I think you can do, which we do with my niece, for example, and my little brother who is 10 years old and my niece is 5 years old. So we try to have like check-in points with them. It's not in a very non-threatening way or not in a serious conversation, but we have check-ins with them. We just casually say that, you know, we just check in, like, did what happened at school? Did something unusual happen? Or just when you're changing them, it's like, does anybody ever change you, lift your top? And because the reason why children don't tell you anything, because for them it wasn't a big deal. That's why. So momentarily you have to find your moments, you know, when you're just giving them a bath or something and saying, oh, nobody should touch you here. Did anybody ever touch you here before? But you say that in a really non-threatening way. The child doesn't get scared that it's, oh, I've done something wrong, that kind of thing. That stuff you can do. And if you have a suspect, for example, that you think, oh, you know, this person has been alone with my child, even if the person is really nice, you can check in with the child saying, I don't know, you can observe their behavior on them. If a child has been abused by someone, the child acts differently with them, you see? If it's repeated, they will have some unusualness, because what predators do, like those kind of people, they only sexually abuse either their own relatives. There's two types of child sexual abusers. They either just abuse their own family members because they're scared elsewhere, or they only abuse people outside their family, right? Mm-hmm. And you'll see there's a change of dynamic.
I always thought it was about whoever they can access, like they're just predators, or they'll access a child who seems quite vulnerable and they'll just go for it. But I guess that falls into the latter category, like you've mentioned, if it's an external person.
According to research, there's only two types, really. Because I think they only stick to family because they understand family, they have access to it. Typically, the kind of cases and people who have been, sentenced for their acts have always been in two categories. It's rare that they abuse children outside. It's, you get caught. I mean, they take their precautions. You will see, like, if it's within a family member, it should be easier for you to see, okay, this child actually spent alone time. And if it's a cousin, you know, it's not always, the child doesn't have to always be a girl, a boy. And if he spends time with a particular person, an adult, you'll see normally they're really happy, but they spend more time away. And then when the child comes back and he asks about the child will give you some sort of, there will be some things that you can pick up. Right. So I think as an adult, if your child spends any alone time with another adult, and if you have anything that, you know, seems a little bit odd and different, investigate that. But you have to investigate that very carefully. If the child, you know, feels anything that the mom has realized something or dad has, they won't tell you anything, because children pick up these things a lot because they don't want to be in trouble, you see, and they will outright lie to you. Or hide things from you. So you just have to do it in a very delicate way where they think it's okay, it's an open space, I can talk about that, and they will just, you know, slyly tell you, I guess.
I think also what's important, like, I think another thing that's, like, for me, I've learned over the years, is the idea that when it comes to really sensitive topics like this, in general, learning how to speak to children is a skill in itself, and also, like, just in their emotional development, because it was something that, again, like, I really struggled to I used to teach children, and the age gap between me and my sister is obviously, I think, 16 years, and then it's a very big age gap. I have never had a baby sibling before, so it was really interesting, and I wanted to make sure that, you know, wherever happened in life, you could come talk to me. And then I realized I actually don't have the skills for that, so naturally I kind of, like, googled and did some research. And I think a really interesting book I came across is How to Talk So Kids Will Listen, and How to Listen So Kids Will Talk. I can't remember the author of it, but it was just example of, like, how to develop a skill, certain skills to, like, allow children to open up, not just about sensitive topics like this, but in general. Because what can happen is that it's very intimidating when anyone who is, even if it's a sister or a parent, talks to you suddenly so sensitively and so empathetically, when generally they're not like that. Because you know how you said, oh, you can be non-threatening about it, but if you never generally speak to a child like that, even if you are employing a very, you know, empathetic and gentle tone, if you're not usually like that, like it can come across as threatening to a child because it's out of the norm. It's not how you usually behave. And I think, again, not just when it comes to sexual abuse or like even other like bullying or anything that could happen that in a child's life that is very sensitive and can affect their development, just everyday general conversation, ensuring the way you speak to children is it's not like it matches that same energy when you approach it sensitive topics, because that enables them to just generally talk generally talk to you because they feel listened and they feel heard. And it's, again, a skill that we're not really taught. Like, again, I never really learned the skill. I never really, you know, not everyone undergoes that kind of intensive training as maybe teachers or counselors who work with children all the time do. But it's ironic because at the end of the day, children make up a big part of our society. So really, we should all kind of undergo some sort of, you know, take it upon ourselves to learn as well. Because you don't have to directly work with children to be around children. We all know that from just being around them all the time. And it makes such a difference. And I feel like, again, when to having quite sensitive conversation with adults as well, even when it comes to sensitive with adults around sexual abuse or emotional abuse, it could be literally anything. Mimicking, like, using those same techniques can be applied to adults as well. And it helps with your emotional bonds with them. And yeah. It's something I kind of picked up again over having a younger sibling.
Yeah, I agree with that. And that's a really, really good point you've made here. I think in general, when you're a parent, and I think these are the things that we can do and I guess raise more awareness of or encourage people to do. Just learn about more, I guess, generally how the social moral development of children, how children's minds work. And I think when you have a healthy relationship generally with a child, when there are set boundaries, is disciplinary already in place, right? When a child feels like, okay, it's just like Nusa with the example of magical kisses or Ari for respecting the tickling situation. When you're respecting a child, the child is picking that up. So they're respecting themselves, right? So when you give them that privacy that you are your own being, I'm respecting you, they're learning to protect themselves, right? If you're kind of ensuring other areas, automatically the child sexual part will be prevented accordingly, right? Because they're learning about these things. So it just comes under general parenting, as you said, Nusa. So if a parent is taking enough care, I guess, or enough time to learn about how to communicate with children, if a child, you know, comes to you if they've fallen down, a lot of children don't even come to their parents when they get hurt because they feel like the parents are going to discipline them, they're going to shout at them. So they don't feel safe emotionally, right? There's also those sort of things. So if you take care of, you know, on a larger picture, you're going to prevent your child not from just child sexual abuse, any sort of, like a lot of things, you will make it easier for the child, I guess, in general.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's true. That's that building of trust, isn't it, really? To say you can come speak to me about anything, whether that's, you know, whether that's bullying or that the fact that the very trivial fact that you've just fallen over and you've grazed your knee, or your elbow, and you know instead of just hiding it and being like, oh, I'm gonna get in trouble, mummy or daddy or auntie or whoever's the guardian at the time is going to tell me off, rather than kind of having that in place, you can say, you know, it's fine, speak to me about anything, because that kind of opens the floor and the safe space for if there are bigger issues like sexual abuse, for example, then they can actually come over and speak to you about it. So yeah, that's really important, as both of you have mentioned, that, you know, building that trust over time is an essential part of raising the child, but being part of the child's life, again, because it's not just in our homes but also outside, if we're a youth worker or a teacher or anything like that, and we do kind of have children and in children that are kind of looking up to us, or children that kind of feel like we are their safeguard, because obviously when you're at school, other than your parents or your kind of close family, when you're at school, for example, you do feel like your teachers are the people that you go to if anything's happening in the playground or in the classroom, right? It's always that kind of, that relationship between the child and the teacher, where your teacher is a trusted adult, for example. So in that situation, you've got to kind of be aware as well of all these things about, they might not talk about everything, but of course they wouldn't, you're not the parent in that respective profession, but they they need to kind of be able to say, look, there's something is going on here, and maybe I can tell my teacher some snippets of something, and my teacher might be able to tell my mom or dad if they can't tell the parent themselves. So maybe that is kind of an interesting aspect, I suppose, as well. Okay, that's really dense. It's quite dense, isn't it? And how do you feel like in terms of the way, I guess it's the relationship with themselves, but also in terms of sexuality and kind of the whole, you know, there's this whole, I guess, this all coming out movement, that's a lot, you know, campaigns and stuff like that that we're having in society today. I mean, in terms of like, does sexual abuse kind of play a role in facilitating some sort of changes, I suppose, or some sort of, I don't know, some sort of, I guess, how the young person, if there's a person who's been abused in their life, do you feel like it has an impact on them and them questioning their sexuality at some point?
I wouldn't necessarily say sexuality in terms of what they prefer, you know, I mean, that's a separate topic itself, but it affects them. I think it affects how they view their sexual self, if that makes sense. I think some individuals who've experienced child sexual abuse, they suppress their sexual being for a long time, right? They could do that. It's not always, or they could go the other way around, being hypersexual, because they've been exposed to that so early on. I think it narrows down to two things that I would primarily have seen with my young women from my group, age 16 to 25. It's how they see themselves and their body primarily. That affects the body image is more the complex area rather than sexuality itself. How they see themselves versus how they let the world see themselves. And I'm talking about romantic situations here. So the first case where they suppress it, it's like they kind of stay away from romantic relationships altogether. They don't even let themselves feel anything sexual because they were so put off with what happened to them, right? So they suppress that. So they don't have normal functional relationships. I've seen a lot of survivors who struggle to have sex in their relationship, you know, and this is not about just religious or cultural boundaries. I'm speaking from a general point of view, or some people who avoid relationships altogether and get really traumatized. So there is that. And the other is where they're hypersexual. They have multiple partners. They're just doing things. They have no idea why they're doing it for. It's to please other people. So the concept of like a normal healthy child who grew up, developed the sexual feelings is very natural. They feel things and they do things because they want to do it. And the other person feels the same way. But for a survivor, it's quite complex, to be honest with you, unless they put a lot of effort in understanding what they truly want versus what they're actually kind of, because when you're so, as a child, you're supposed to be protected, right? Because nobody respected your body. You it's very difficult for you then suddenly grow up and respecting your body. So a lot of the time survivors find themselves in very sexual situations that is very, very bad. And they feel bad about that, but then they still do it. They're like addicted to that because that's what feels home to them, if that makes sense. But if you presented them with a normal situation, where let's say for a girl who could have a normal relationship with guys respecting her, it's very difficult for her to accept that because she's used to the somebody who just wants to have her for sex and just touching her body. And she doesn't even like it, but that's what she's used to, for example. So it was very difficult to kind of work with, you know, survivors like that, kind of just to undo that, just to teach them this is not how it's supposed to be. You know, listen to your body, because they're not listening to themselves. They're just so used to listening what the predators say. And that's the template they take out to the world, if that makes sense. These are very difficult implications that I've seen, more than being confused about what do you actually want. Do you like men, women? These are not the issues I've seen mainly.
I think hypersexuality is quite an interesting one, because I think for me, I think in general, it's interesting in the sense that sex positivity, like in the turn of like the 21st century in particular, has really skyrocketed, and it's been great for many different things. But when sexual abuse survivors engage with that kind of narrative, it can be quite dangerous, in the sense that it can kind of not exploit, but kind of prey on people's hypersexuality. And like, the sex positivity is about having a healthy relationship with your sexuality rather than hypersexualizing yourself, but those lines become really blurry sometimes. If I don't know if you've come across absolutely. That by any chance, but that's what I've kind of seen.
Yeah, you're definitely right, Nissa. I mean, whilst the positive sex attitudes are helping them, but they are kind of putting themselves in a really vulnerable situation, in dangerous situation also, right? And it gets linked to young girls being in a room full of men that are over their age, for example, and doing certain things to themselves that they later then regret. And you can't even get, for example, here the legal system plays in. You can't seek help because if their age of over 18, they can do whatever they want. But then you know they're mentally being really abused and they're in a situation that could physically be very harmful for them. But you can't take that to court because they're consenting to that. Because in their head, the concept of consenting sex and normal sex, a sexual life, and I'm not talking about just intercourse here, anything to do with sexuality is so blurred, and it's actually really negative what they see as pleasure. And the concept of pleasure is not even there. They're actually being abused and they don't understand that. And to rewind that back is really, really hard. And I've definitely seen that. And I used to get really worried sometimes, the things that they would tell me about their boyfriends. And I'm like, are you even safe to go and visit that kind of person, you know? But I couldn't seek legal help because they were after a certain age.
That's interesting you say that, because I was actually going to ask you about the legal system and how that plays a role in, in these situations where sexual abuse has occurred, and the young person or the person's kind of mentioned it to their social worker or their counsellor, or, you know, they've come to a safe space and they've actually mentioned it to somebody who's supporting them. And I know you're not a counsellor or you're not kind of in that field, but I guess you're supporting these ladies here. And how has it been? Have you ever come across like a situation where you had to get involved, had to get the legal system involved? And if you have, then, you know, what kind of implications has it had? Has it been kind of skewed in favor? Because we've always kind of mentioned rape cases, they're not taken as seriously as we would like them to take on board. And unfortunately, that may be because it's, you know, predominantly seen as a female issue. And you know, unfortunately, and you know, it might be controversial to say this, but we do kind of still live in a man's world, as they like to say, even in the 21st century, although things are changing slowly but surely. So yeah, like in terms of the legal system being in place here, and how have you ever had like a story, have you got a story to share with us, or have you had any kind of run-ins with the legal system when it came to kind of helping out a young person who has had a story about sexual abuse and wanting the perpetrators to actually be taken accountable or made accountable?
Absolutely. This is a really, really important and a good question. And I have three things to say here. The legal system, when it comes to these matters, are very disappointing. But I'm going to start with number one, why it's so difficult to get help for child sexual abuse or sexual abuse or any abuse in general here. With child sexual abuse particularly, because those victims don't understand that this is abuse sometimes. And, you know, sometimes you can obviously see they're being abused. And if you took it to court, they know it's abuse. But if the victim itself doesn't recognize it as an abuse, you can't do anything about it. Nothing you can do about it. Like if I know they're going to go home and they're, you know, and she's going to get raped by her brother, and she's consenting to that because that's how she thinks it's normal, there's nothing you can do that. Nothing you can do about it. Do you understand? Because the individual needs to recognize that as an abuse. It's not like somebody's physically beating you. That you can prove, so somebody can't do that. But when it comes to sexual stuff, it's so blurred. Unless the victim recognizes it as an abuse, absolutely nothing you can do about it. Number two, so if they're younger, below the age of 18, and you know someone's being sexually abused, you can report that. You can safeguard that child because they're a child. They don't need to consent to it. You can take legal actions for that. And that's important for people to know. And if they're above 18, you can't do anything about it unless they want to. And when it comes to actually helping child sexual abuse and court cases for victims who have recognized that as an abuse and have grown up and want to seek help, it's so, so difficult because there's no evidence left, obviously. And it's all relying on memory, right? And now how do you present memory to court? Very difficult. So often what the legal system does is, number one, they don't take you seriously most of the time. And when they do, it's a very few cases that actually manage to go to court. And we do assist them with that. there's always questions about, okay, how reliable is this person's memory? Because there's also the other side, right? Some people do use that kind of thing just to make up lies and make other people get in trouble. So the court has to obviously play fair, I guess. So they make it quite difficult. So they will give you very, you know, difficult memory tests to take, which is not psychological or research found. The lawyers will ask you silly questions like let's say somebody's 23 right now and they were abused when they were 6 or 7. They'll say, you lived in that house with this individual? Yes. Okay, so which side of the door, was it on the right side or the left side? Where was the handle? Which color was it? You see, now studying psychology and studying aspects of memory, I know how the memory works. You know, memory doesn't sit there and, you know, we don't store everything we see. That's not how the human mind works. And the way you, store emotional memories or things that happen to you is a lot stronger. And negative memories are a lot stronger to storage anyway than positive in general. And any researcher will tell you that. But does the legal system know that? No, they don't. So I remember had one case for me, one of my girls, and she forgot which side of the handle the door was when she was freaking 6 years old. And what happened? Her case was dismissed because her memory wasn't reliable enough for her to then prosecute.
So this is another question I kind of want to ask. I feel like it's going down another route and I want to draw back to another question. But you know, when we talk about child sexual abuse as we grow up as women, a lot of the time we kind of, so usually it happens within the confines of our own home or in places that we were meant to feel safe. And so a big part of us sometimes when it comes to the prosecution aspect, and a lot of men will say that, like, you know, why didn't you say anything? Why don't you go prosecute that person now? From your experience, do you think it is even like, is it worth the mental like strain to, as an adult, if you've been sexually abused, to go prosecute that person? Because that's something that I've always kind of wondered about, is the idea that, okay, so we know that we've been sexually abused. And a lot of the time, I feel like, again, the conversation rotates around, you know, our self-healing, our, you know, overcoming it, etc. But I feel like a lot of the time, there isn't much like work, or not work, a lot of conversation surrounding prosecuting that person. And for me, the impression is that it's like, quite bluntly, like even the way you said it, it sometimes it doesn't feel worth it. Like, and then that's so like, sorry. And that's so scary to me, in the sense that, oh, it's just not worth it at that point. If something like that in a case can be dismissed, what can I do to get over that? Because I feel like the individual being prosecuted can play a big part in someone's healing, in that it reaffirms that what they went through didn't, you know, was a crime, and, you know, and it was wrong, and that person was wrong for doing that to them. And it can help in the healing. But in terms of like, would you even recommend that if someone went through that, they should go prosecute that person? If they know their memory, like, you know, the circumstances could be quite similar to the case you described.
Yeah. I would definitely encourage that, because I think the reason why the legal system is so poor at dealing such cases, because it doesn't happen much, you know. The research is there. We understand how memory works. We know exactly how memory works. Any psychology graduate would tell you these things, and the legal system just needs to make an effort to bring a memory expert or somebody understands one or two things about the memory, at least, you know, not lawyers who have never understood anything about memory, to fight those cases. There is not enough investments done. There's no funding for that. So though the issues that you've mentioned can be dealt with if there was a pressure in the legal system to make an effort, you know. So yeah. If there were more cases and people are, yeah, sorry, carry on.
So I was just saying, if you're saying more people are coming forward with the experiences, then it would apply pressure to the legal system, because it's becoming a case where they can't just dismiss each case. They actually have to, and because that pressure isn't there, is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. You will see in any large cases, if there's brain injury, there will be an expert, a medical expert that comes and understands the brain, talks about that, right? That's normalized, because we've had it so many times since people started driving, those sort of cases have arisen. So the court or the legal system had to accommodate to that. With child sexual abuse, there isn't many people that come. And because not many people are going, because we kind of focus on the result, don't we? Am I going to win the... It shouldn't be about that. If you can win, great. If you can prosecute them, yet. But if more and more people were getting dragged to court, the predators would have something to fear about, because it actually, people actually do take them to the court, because it, no one's doing anything about it. It's the silence aspect that keeps, you know, sexual abusers going and keep doing what they do, and victims staying silent as they do. And the fact that it's still a taboo topic is because no one's talking about it. Nobody feels shy about talking about a car accident because it happens so many times, but it's happening as many times with children, you see, because no one's talking about it. No one's doing anything about it. It's going to stay like that. So I definitely encourage more people to go out there, force shake a few things in the legal system, get them to get memory experts, get them, you know, they should be paid memory experts already there. That, you know, even like when they're questioning people, the way they ask questions to like child sexual victim, like it's so leading, and you end up answering questions that you will end up dismissing the case because no one wants to deal with it. Does that make sense? And we know if you study like psychology and law together, they will teach you like everything about the legal system that they do wrong during the interview process, that then, you know, kind of predicts the results of the case anyway. So the research is there, the knowledge is here, no one's utilizing it. So yeah, that's where it goes really at the end.
I just wanted also, and just moving on to another question, in the sense that what kind of, so we kind of spoke about like the legal system, children, and, you know, emotional relationships with them. But I wanted to kind of shift to, and we also spoke about like the later mental relationships and kind of mental physical like relationships we have as adults, as sexual abuse survivors. I just wanted to ask, in terms of the actual physical implications of sexual abuse onto the body directly, like more materialistically, what that does to someone, because obviously, I don't know, I think that might be a tough question to ask, but it was just something me and Arifa were both curious about, because we know that there's a lot of mental impact of sexual abuse, but what is the physical impact on our actual bodies of being exploited sexually and being, you know, subjected to something physical against our consent? Like, what is the physical impact in your experience? Have you seen, what has it been?
So that's a really important question. I'm really glad you asked that, because there is actually a book on it about sexual abuse and pain, and also some studies that kind of shows what sort of pain you can experience. I actually have the book, but I'm very good, very bad at remembering names, but I'll send you a copy of that later.
Yeah, you should definitely send the copy to me. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I went to there was actually a huge conference back in 2017 that I attended, and he spoke about so many different types of pain that is actually not even physical pain. Like, it's different. Every person that experienced child sexual abuse will experience their experience differently. Some people are very good at just kind of putting it at the back of their head and moving on. But it can kind of, you know, take surface in physical pain or psychological pain. And sometimes the third case is when there's actually psychological pain, but it actually feels like physical pain. You can have sleep-related issues. You can have high migraine issues. The biggest one is memory loss. So any child that experienced child sexual abuse and had that for continuously long amount of time, they have memory-related issues, okay? So there's loss of memory. They forget things quite quickly. You're right, Nessa. Exactly, bang on. Yeah, because it's so painful and the child was pushing it back. And because as an adult, you try, even when you're a teenager, you start realizing, okay, something was wrong, and you don't talk about it. You learn to suppress it. It's that ability to suppress that affects the memory. So you will see these kind of people will tend to forget restaurant names. They'll forget movie names. They'll forget a lot of different, like very normal things, but they're very, very smart people. And then they're the kind of people that get A stars quite easily. But then you look at them, you're like, how do you forget everything and still get such great results? You see? So there's something about their memory, they just find it very difficult to access, right? And you will also see sexual abuse, like survivors, you will see when they grow up, it actually surfaces as they grow older. You'll see like survivors at the younger age, up to 28, they've managed their emotions really well. They're actually okay, they're functioning, they have jobs. The older that they get, the more difficult it becomes for them if they don't heal properly. So you see a lot of the side effects actually show later in the years. Right? And it can trigger from anything to nothing, really. It can come out of nowhere. It can manifest in like different examples. It's different for different people. I know people who are happily married. They were survivors. They had children and they went on a mental breakdown where the marriages have fallen apart and they were hospitalized. They weren't eating. They developed anorexia. It's different for different people because, you know, what triggers you is different, right? The content, it's different. So it's hard to draw any lines how it will affect you. Some survivors happen to have a very flexible life and a really good life throughout because they have addressed their issues. And, you know, you don't have to always go to therapy, but they've done something with it, right? They've accepted it. They know what the trigger points are and they manage them well. You can't get rid of effects that happens to you. Some survivors together will have, they're very vulnerable. So they cry a lot. Let's say, for example, somebody and they get easily like, you know, like really sensitive, but they've managed, they know that's because they're just a bit vulnerable. They manage that well. They don't just dole on it, for example. Others get very anxious. You can develop OCD. That's a very common one. Depression, of course, there's a very common one. But it's a lot of the complexity will come in romantic relationships. You will see they have really complex relationships. They end up in abusive relationships, or they always put themselves in relationships where they're not appreciated and they get all this anxiety related to that, or they struggle with sex in general. I've seen that more in women, even women, married women who then come and say that I don't enjoy sex at all. It feels very traumatizing for them, but they're married, they have children, they have partners, have no idea that they're going through that. That's because they have associated sex with a very difficult, painful thing, and they've never accepted that it could be something positive. So they need psychological therapy for that so they can actually enjoy normal life, if that makes sense. Yeah. So there's a lot of stuff. I'll send you that book. It's fascinating how it manifests later in years.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is also the fact that you were saying how obviously one of the key examples and what I think a lot of people expect is that, oh, if you're a sexual abuse victim, that you will struggle to have sex, which is true. But I think it's important to like the idea that it manifests very differently. So sometimes, because a key aspect of it is the idea of low self-esteem. Like that's a big theme running throughout all these different issues. It's the low self-esteem aspect. It's the lack of feeling control over your life. And that's when it can manifest into so many, like addictions is a big part of it, which I've really noticed is the idea that, for example, like OCD is an example of it, like you just mentioned, you know, if you suffer from low self-esteem and you don't feel like you have control over your circumstances, then you might naturally have display some symptoms of OCD. Or another example, an eating disorder, it could be overeating or undereating. And a lot of the time people can't make that connection and be like, why would you have, for example, an eating disorder if you were sexually abused? That doesn't make sense. Like, you know, that's got nothing to do with sex. But I think it's important to recognize that, you know, it doesn't have to directly correlate. Like being a sexual abuse victim, there could be things in your life that you just do and you assumed are just part of your personality and are just something you struggle with without making the connections, without like seeing how all the dots connect. And that's why therapy is a really great thing, because, you know, psychologists are, you know, trained to see, allow you to see the connections in those dots. Like, do you see what I mean? Whereas we naturally don't see those things because we just, in general, like we struggle to see how the dots may connect and how you may as an individual think that, oh, you know, I'm over my sexual abuse or I've moved on from it, but it is actually still there manifesting just differently in something that's veiled completely different to what you think it is. Yes,
that's interesting.
If you don't deal with that, it can really carry on.
Sorry go on.
No, you carry on.
I was just going to ask that, just to bounce off Nusa's point as well, to add to it, the idea of feeling dirty as well, because there is this whole, you know, this is a feeling of dirty when it comes to rape victim, for example. Have you seen that manifest as well in young women who have actually gone through abuse? Even if that is, you know, just a touch somewhere, which is obviously still a big deal. Mm-hmm. Have you you know, that whole idea as well, have you seen that and does that correlate as well?
It does. It's when you feel like you feel dirty, other people feel betrayed. Because sometimes, you know, your body responds, right? You know, certain fluid releases during the times of rape. And the women think to themselves, I never wanted to sleep with this person. Why did my body respond, right? But so they sometimes feel betrayed. I've experienced that a lot. They feel betrayed by their own body. And they end up disliking themselves for that. So you have complexities like where they feel dirty, they don't like themselves. And it, like I said, there's so many different examples, Arifa. We could spend hours and hours of different types of way that it manifests itself. There's so many different dysfunctionalities that come from that, the way you see yourself. And it's feeling like you're not good enough also because somebody treated you like dirt. And then you start feeling that about yourself and you start treating yourself like that. There are some survivors, we had to run a session on cleaning because they don't clean themselves enough, right? because they don't think they're worth it. And others have OCD. So you have on both extremes that it can manifest. We actually had to run a session on cleaning. We actually made soaps for them. So you can say they need to look after yourselves, because they would come to our sessions and they would smell so bad. But we know before the incidents, certain incidents that they had, they weren't like that. So, but they wouldn't recognize that. And you can't, it's such a touchy topic. So you can't necessarily address that. So we had to do it as, you know, vaguely as we could to send them the message. But coming back to Nusa's point here, without therapy, you don't understand how the experiences that you had in your childhood, how that then manifests. And if you don't do that, you might think, okay, I actually have this. This is my personality. I have one individual that I know who has memory issues. But this particular individual had so much potential. But once they actually recognize that this is related to their childhood, now they actually make more effort when they attend classes or work. Now, but they're really successful in their career, for example, right? Because I've learned to be organized. But if you didn't address that, this particular person couldn't have had those potentials, you see? They could have always lived with that, oh, I can't remember anything. You know what I mean? And many other things, like the dirt element, it's so big. And feeling low of yourself, also lack of confidence. Lack of confidence is a massive one. And a lot of people, it's a combination of those factors. They feel dirty, they don't feel good enough, and it leads to suicidal thoughts. That's the big one that I wanted to say. I wanted to keep that for last, really. That's the big one. When all of these factors become too heavy on them, it's very common. They say that most survivors, above 65% of them, have considered killing themselves at some point, which is huge.
Wow.
So yeah, it gets as dark as that, really.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because I wanted to ask you, it sounds like a really dense job and it's really, really challenging and emotionally challenging as well. How do you separate your own kind of life from work? Because sometimes, like, obviously we're all, when we're working or when we're studying is, I guess, it's easier because we have a passion to study for a certain thing, or certain subject. But when it comes to like work, and when it's something so intense, how do you kind of separate that from your personal life? And, you know, that challenge, how do you kind of as people in working in the field, whether they're psychologists or whether they're working in the field, how do your colleagues, for example, make that distinction, and, you know, kind of support yourselves, I suppose, in that respect?
Yeah, that's a really important question, because we're now speaking of kind of keeping the people that are trying to help others safe. And yeah, so that's a very important one. And it's actually very not talked about at all. So I'm really glad you touched on this. You'll see a lot of the people that do that kind of field work, they have some experiences. There's something about them that can relate to these topics. It could be them themselves or somebody that they know that went through that. It's very rare that somebody who's very random, have nothing to do with this experience, jump into topic like that, because it's such a heavy topic. I don't think, unless you really have some personal, you know, motivations for that, it's very difficult to work in that field. And also, I think for myself, I've seen that so much. So I just wanted to help theirs, but it's so difficult. There are, you know, moments where you would be in a session and you can't show your emotions in those sessions. And it's also by law, especially if one of your clients are involved in the legal system, they actually write a letter to you saying that you cannot disclose anything to them or can't show any emotions, because then they feel like, okay. So when you try to help somebody and they're explaining their emotions to you and they're crying all over the places, and if you react to that, they feel then bad. Because naturally what happens with survivors or anyone that's gone through really traumatic experiences, a bit vulnerable, they're needy for approval. They want to make sure that they look after you, that you like them. When you're up, if they feel like they're upsetting you, they will stop, right? Because their nature is always to help others and just do things for other people. So I had to always make sure that I don't show any emotions. So it's all about them. It's 100% about them. But I'm a human being, so I had to take loo breaks sometimes from the sessions, so I don't show any emotions. But I couldn't say, Arifa, 100% that I would go away one day and at home and not think about what I've just heard. At times, it would bother me for 3 days. And I think it drove all social workers or anyone that works in this sort of difficult fields. But you have to remind yourself eventually, and what we do, I do that for myself, I think others do that, you realize why you do this for, and you need to be strong for them. You have to be. And but you have to have your own personal network. Like, you know, Arifa, you've been a great support for me. Supported me a lot at Survivors Together. There are moments I felt really troublesome and I needed to, you know, needed to express it. Because if I wasn't able to let it out, I won't be able to help the women. So thank you for being here for me, I guess. And I think any social worker needs that outlet. It could be a friend, it could be anything, but you need to let it out for yourself as well.
Yeah, I can imagine it being really, we've had like different conversations before, and it's been interesting because like Mona's just kind of so knowledgeable and I've always have all these questions, so it's nice that actually some of the questions that we do have the audience can, and as her, can actually kind of acknowledge them and kind of address them to you, so you can actually share your knowledge. So yeah, thank you for that, and I'm glad to have been of help. So good.
Thank you.
Sorry, Niz. We're just having a connection moment here, especially in lockdown. We haven't seen each other for the past like 5 months or so.
No, it is lovely to see, and it's great to have like such inspiring women within your own network to like put like doing such great things, and it's like, you know, it's lovely to see you guys support each other in that sense. But yeah, I think this has been a really interesting conversation. We've been talking for an hour or so now, so I'm really glad to have Mona onto the podcast and having her share her experiences and the work that she's done. And learning all, I've learned so much today, and I'm sure the audience has too. Is there anything else that like kind of concluding words of advice you may maybe give to our audiences? Or if there's anyone, like I would say maybe what would you give to current people currently battling with getting over sexual abuse, and also to the other half of the audience who perhaps have never experienced it, and what they can do to support people within their own community or family members or friends? Like Mona, what, like given your experience, what would you say to that?
I have two things to say to both parts, to those that have experienced it, to survivors, to anyone that's experienced any sexual abuse, really, child sexual abuse, and that's for men, women, anyone really. If you are going through it, please seek help. Seek help. I mean, in terms of therapy or anyone, if it's medical, do whatever you need to do, but seek some help. But also, please take a step to legal. If there's anything you can do legally, you will not make it just a difference for yourself, but you make a difference for a lot of others as well. And we'll make the world a better place together if we take some initiatives to make a change. And for those who haven't experienced anything, I'm really glad that you haven't experienced anything. But if you know somebody who has, again, encourage them on the first two points I've made. Encourage them to seek help. Encourage healing for them. And encourage them to take legal steps if they can. And number two for you is the preventative method. Any children that you may know of, or anyone that's vulnerable, try the preventative methods. Try to stop it before it occurs. And that's all I ask from you.
That's great. Yeah. Is there anything else you'd like to say? That's amazing. Yeah. And in terms of Arifa, there's anything you'd like to say?
No, I think it's been a really interesting and informative session with Mona. So thank you for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure. And of course, it's just nice to have not only your friend, but somebody who's speaking from experience in terms of the work that she's done. I really, really appreciate you sharing all your knowledge with myself and viewers, and of course Nusa had some very interesting questions as well. I think you mentioned something about suicide, I think, at one point, and you said you wanted to touch upon it maybe towards the end of the podcast, or you wanted to keep as a light as a final point. Is that something that you still would like to kind of mention if you haven't covered it already? And if so, if it's important, I'm happy for you to kind of tell us a little bit about that before we actually do conclude, really. Is that something that you
I think this is a large topic, so I won't go much in detail, but it's just the same concept, really. If you're going through that right now, if you need to seek help, I think I touched upon that topic more as a thing that survivors tend to think about. And if that's an issue that you are dealing with, and anybody who knows someone's dealing with, regardless of child sexual abuse, just help them, of course. Take an extra step to make a difference. That's all from my side. But from my side, thank you so much to you both, Arifa and Nusa, for having me here today. I'm ever so grateful for having this opportunity to speak to you both, and I hope that to the listeners that I've been of help to you today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.